Chapter 4 Pioneering Specialized Hardware. In Chapter 1, you discover that one of the reasons for the failure of early AI efforts was a lack of suitable hardware. The hardware just couldn't perform tasks quickly enough for even mundane needs, much less something as complex as simulating human thought. This issue is described at some length in the movie The Imitation Game, in which Alan Turing finally cracked the Enigma code by cleverly looking for a particular phrase, Heil Hitler, in each message. Without that particular flaw in the way that operators used the Enigma, the computer equipment that Turing used would never have worked fast enough to solve the problem, and the movie had no small amount of griping about the matter. If anything, the historical account, what little of it is fully declassified, shows that Turing's problems were more profound than the movie expressed. Fortunately, standard off-the-shelf hardware can overcome the speed issue for many problems today, which is where this chapter begins. Remember, to truly begin to simulate human thoughts requires specialized hardware, and even the best specialized hardware isn't up to the task today. Almost all standard hardware relies on the von Neumann architecture, which separates memory from computing, creating a wonderfully generic processing environment that just doesn't work well for some kinds of algorithms because the speed of the bus between the processor and memory creates a von Neumann bottleneck. The second part of this chapter helps you understand the various methods used to overcome the von Neumann bottleneck so that complex, data-intensive algorithms run faster. Even with custom hardware specially designed to speed computations, a machine designed to simulate human thought can run only as fast as its inputs and outputs will allow. Consequently, people are working to create a better environment in which the hardware can operate. This need can be addressed in a number of ways, but this chapter discusses two: enhancing the capabilities of the underlying hardware and using specialized sensors. These changes to the hardware environment work well, but as the following material explains, it still isn't enough to build a human brain. Ultimately, hardware is useless, even with enhancements, if the humans who rely on it can't interact with it effectively. The final section of this chapter describes techniques for making those interactions more efficient. These interactions are simply the result of the combination of enhanced output and clever programming. Just as Alan Turing used a trick to make his computer seem to do more than it was able to do, these techniques make modern computers look like miracle workers. In fact, the computer understands nothing. All the credit goes to the persons who program the computer. Relying on standard hardware. Most AI projects that you create will at least begin with standard hardware, because modern off-the-shelf components actually provide significant processing power, especially when compared to components from the 1980s when AI first began to produce usable results. Consequently, even if you can't ultimately perform production-level work by using standard hardware, you can get far enough along with your experimental and pre-production code to create a working model that will eventually process a full data set. Understanding the standard hardware. The architecture, structure of the standard PC hasn't changed since John von Neumann first proposed it in 1946. Reviewing the history shows you that the processor connects to memory and peripheral devices through a bus in PC products as early as 1981, and long before. All these systems use the von Neumann architecture because this architecture provides significant benefits in modularity. Reading the history tells you that these devices allow upgrades to every component as individual decisions, allowing increases in capability. For example, within limits, you can increase the amount of memory or storage available to any PC. You can also use advanced peripherals. However, all these elements connect through a bus. Remember, that a PC becomes more capable doesn't change the fact of its essential architecture. So, the PC you use today has the same architecture as devices created long ago. They're simply more capable. In addition, the form factor of a device doesn't affect its architecture either. The computers in your car rely on a bus system for connectivity that directly relies on the von Neumann architecture. Even if the kind of bus is different, the architecture is the same. Lest you think any device remains unaffected, look at the block diagram for a BlackBerry. It too relies on a von Neumann setup. Consequently, almost every device you can conceive of today has a similar architecture, despite having different form factors, bus types, and essential capabilities. Describing standard hardware deficiencies. The ability to create a modular system does have significant benefits, especially in business. The ability to remove and replace individual components keeps costs low while allowing incremental improvements in both speed and efficiency. However, as with most things, there is no free lunch. The modularity provided by the von Neumann architecture comes with some serious deficiencies. Von Neumann bottleneck. Of all the deficiencies, the von Neumann bottleneck is the most serious when considering the requirements of disciplines such as AI, machine learning, and even data science. You can find this particular deficiency discussed in more detail in the Considering the von Neumann bottleneck section later in this chapter. Single points of failure. Any loss of connectivity with the bus necessarily means that the computer fails immediately rather than gracefully. Even in systems with multiple processors, the loss of a single process, which should simply produce a loss of capability, instead inflicts complete system failure. The same problem occurs with the loss of other system components. Instead of reducing functionality, the entire system fails. Given that AI often requires continuous system operation, the potential for serious consequences escalates with the manner in which an application relies on the hardware. Single-mindedness. The von Neumann bus can either retrieve an instruction or retrieve the data required to execute the instruction, but it can't do both. Consequently, when data retrieval requires several bus cycles, the processor remains idle, reducing its ability to perform instruction-intensive AI tasks even more. Tasking. When the brain performs a task, a number of synapses fire at one time, allowing simultaneous execution of multiple operations. The original von Neumann design allowed just one operation at a time, and only after the system retrieved both the required instruction and data. Computers today typically have multiple cores which allow simultaneous execution of operations in each core. However, application code must specifically address this requirement, so the functionality often remains unused. Examining the Harvard architecture difference. You may encounter the Harvard architecture during your hardware travels because some systems employ a modified form of this architecture to speed processing. Both the von Neumann architecture and Harvard architecture rely on a bus topology. However, when working with a von Neumann architecture system, the hardware relies on a single bus and a single memory area for both instructions and data, whereas the Harvard architecture relies on individual buses for instructions and data and can use separate physical memory areas. The use of individual buses enables a Harvard architecture system to retrieve the next instruction while waiting for data to arrive from memory for the current instruction, thereby making the Harvard architecture both faster and more efficient. However, reliability suffers because now you have two failure points for each operation, the instruction bus and the data bus. Microcontrollers, such as those that power your microwave, often use the Harvard architecture. In addition, you might find it in some unusual places for a specific reason. The iPhone and Xbox 360 both use modified versions of the Harvard architecture that rely on a single memory area, rather than two, but still rely on separate buses. The reason for using the architecture in this case is digital rights management, DRM. You can make the code area of memory read-only so that no one can modify it or create new applications without permission. From an AI perspective, this can be problematic because one of an AI's capabilities is to write new algorithms, executable code, as needed to deal with unanticipated situations. Because PCs rarely implement a Harvard architecture in its pure form or as its main bus construction, the Harvard architecture doesn't receive much attention in this book. Using GPUs. After creating a prototypical setup to perform the tasks required to simulate human thought on a given topic, you may need additional hardware to provide sufficient processing power to work with the full dataset required of a production system. Many ways are available to provide such processing power, but a common way is to use graphic processing units, GPUs, in addition to the central processor of a machine. The following selections describe the problem domain that a GPU addresses, what precisely is meant by the term GPU, and why a GPU makes processing faster. Considering Alan Turing's bomb machine. Alan Turing's bomb machine wasn't any form of AI. In fact, it isn't even a real computer. It broke Enigma cryptographic messages, and that's it. However, it did provide food for thought for Turing, which eventually led to a paper entitled Computing Machinery and Intelligence that he published in the 1950s that describes the imitation game. However, the bomb itself was actually based on a Polish machine called the Bomba. Even though some sources imply that Alan Turing worked alone, the bomb was produced with the help of many people, most especially Gordon Welchman. Turing also didn't spring from a vacuum ready-made to break German encryption. His time at Princeton was spent with greats like Albert Einstein and John von Neumann, who would go on to invent the concept of computer software. The papers Turing wrote inspired these other scientists to experiment and see what is possible. Specialized hardware of all sorts will continue to appear as long as scientists are writing papers, bouncing ideas off each other, creating new ideas on their own, and experimenting. When you see movies or other media, assuming that they're historically accurate at all, don't leave with the feeling that these people just woke up one morning, proclaimed, "Today I will be brilliant," and went on to do something marvelous. Everything builds on something else, so history is important because it helps show the path followed and illuminates other promising paths, those not followed. Considering the von Neumann bottleneck. The von Neumann bottleneck is a natural result of using a bus to transfer data between the processor, memory, long-term storage, and peripheral devices. No matter how fast the bus performs its task, overwhelming it, that is, forming a bottleneck that reduces speed, is always possible. Over time, processor speeds continue to increase while memory and other device improvements focus on density, the capability to store more in less space. Consequently, the bottleneck becomes more of an issue with every improvement, causing the processor to spend a lot of time being idle. Within reason, you can overcome some of the issues that surround the von Neumann bottleneck and produce small but noticeable increases in application speed. Here are the most common solutions. Caching. When problems with obtaining data from memory fast enough with the von Neumann architecture became evident, hardware vendors quickly responded by adding localized memory that didn't require bus access. This memory appears external to the processor, but as part of the processor package. High-speed cache is expensive, however, so cache sizes tend to be small. Processor caching. Unfortunately, external caches still don't provide enough speed. Even using the fastest RAM available and cutting out the bus access completely doesn't meet the processing capacity needs of the processor. Consequently, vendors started adding internal memory. A cache smaller than the external cache, but with even faster access because it's part of the processor. Prefetching. The problem with caches is that they prove useful only when they contain the correct data. Unfortunately, cache hits prove low in applications that use a lot of data and perform a wide variety of tasks. The next step in making processors work faster is to guess which data the application will require next and load it into cache before the application requires it. Using specialty RAM. You can get buried by RAM alphabet soup because there are more kinds of RAM than most people imagine. Each kind of RAM purports to solve at least part of the von Neumann bottleneck problem, and they do work within limits. In most cases, the improvements revolve around the idea of getting data from memory and onto the bus faster. Two major and many minor factors affect speed. Memory speed, how fast the memory moves data, and latency, how long it takes to locate a particular piece of data. Warning. As with many other areas of technology, hype can become a problem. For example, multi-threading, the act of breaking an application or other set of instructions into discrete execution units that the processor can handle one at a time, is often touted as a means to overcome the von Neumann bottleneck, but it doesn't actually do anything more than add overhead, making the problem worse. Multi-threading is an answer to another problem, making the application more efficient. When an application adds latency issues to the von Neumann bottleneck, the entire system slows. Multi-threading ensures that the processor doesn't waste yet more time waiting for the user or the application, but instead has something to do all the time. Application latency can occur with any processor architecture, not just the von Neumann architecture. Even so, anything that speeds the overall operation of an application is visible to the user and the system as a whole. Defining the GPU. The original intent of a graphics processing unit, GPU, was to process image data quickly and then display the resulting image on screen. During the initial phase of PC evolution, the CPU performed all the processing, which meant that graphics could appear slowly while the CPU performed other tasks. During this time, a PC typically came equipped with a display adapter, which contains little or no processing power. All a display adapter does is to convert the computer data into a visual form. In fact, using just one processor proved almost undoable once the PC moved past text-only displays or extremely simple 16-color graphics. However, GPUs didn't really make any inroads into computing until people began wanting 3D output. At this point, a combination of a CPU and a display adapter simply couldn't do the job. A first step in this direction were systems such as the Hophog 4860, which included a CPU and a special graphics chip, the 80860 in this case, on the motherboard. The 80860 has an advantage in performing calculations extremely fast. Unfortunately, these multiprocessor asynchronous systems didn't quite meet the expectations that people had for them, although they were incredibly fast for systems of the time, and they proved extremely expensive. Plus, there was the whole issue of writing applications that included that second or subsequent chip. The two chips also shared memory, of which there was plenty for these systems. A GPU moves graphics processing from the motherboard to the graphics peripheral board. The CPU can tell the GPU to perform a task, and then the GPU determines the best method for doing so independently of the CPU. A GPU has a separate memory, and the data path for its bus is immense. In addition, a GPU can access the main memory for obtaining data needed to perform a task and to post results independently of the CPU. Consequently, this setup makes modern graphics displays possible. Technical stuff. However, what really sets a GPU apart is that a GPU typically contains hundreds of cores, contrasted with just a few cores for a CPU. Even though the CPU provides more general-purpose functionality, the GPU performs calculations incredibly fast and can move data from the GPU to the display even faster. This ability is what makes the special-purpose GPU a critical component in today's systems. Considering why GPUs work well. As with the 80860 chip described in the previous section, the GPUs today excel at performing the specialized tasks associated with graphics processing, including working with vectors. All those cores performing tasks in parallel really speed AI calculations. In 2011, the Google Brain Project trained an AI to recognize the difference between cats and people by watching movies on YouTube. However, to make this task work, Google used 2,000 CPUs in one of Google's giant data centers. Few people would have the resources required to replicate Google's work. On the other hand, Brian Cadenzaro, NVIDIA's research team, and Andrew Ng, Stanford, were able to replicate Google's work using a set of 12 NVIDIA GPUs. After people understood that GPUs could replace a host of computer systems stocked with CPUs, they could start moving forward with a variety of AI projects. In 2012, Alex Krizhevsky, Toronto University, won the ImageNet Computer Image Recognition Competition using GPUs. In fact, a number of researchers have now used GPUs with amazing success. Creating a specialized processing environment. Deep learning and AI are both non-von Neumann processes, according to many experts such as Massimiliano Versace, CEO of Neurala Inc. Because the task the algorithm performs doesn't match the underlying hardware, all sorts of inefficiencies exist, hacks are required, and obtaining a result is much harder than it should be. Therefore, designing hardware that matches the software is quite appealing. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, undertook one such project in the form of Systems of Neuromorphic Adaptive Plastic Scalable Electronics, SINAPS. The idea behind this approach is to duplicate nature's approach to solving problems by combining memory and processing power rather than keeping the two separate. They actually built the system. It was immense. The SINAPS project did move forward. IBM built a smaller system by using modern technology that was both incredibly fast and power efficient. The only problem is that no one is buying them. Just as many people would argue that Betamax was a better way of storing data than VHS, VHS won out on cost, ease of use, and compelling features. The same holds true for IBM's Synapse offering, True North. Trying to find people who are willing to pay the higher price, programmers who can develop software using the new architecture, and products that genuinely benefit from the chip has been hard. Consequently, a combination of CPUs and GPUs, even with its inherent weaknesses, continues to win out. Remember, eventually someone will likely build a chip that more closely resembles the biologic equivalent of a brain. The current system will probably become unable to produce the desired increases in computing power. In fact, companies such as Google are working on alternatives such as the Tensor Processing Unit, TPU, which actually sees use in applications such as Google Search, Street View, Google Photos, and Google Translate. Because you now have the technology used for actual large-scale applications, some people are also buying the chips, some programmers know how to write applications for them, and compelling products exist that people are demanding. Unlike Synapse, the TPU also relies on well-understood application-specific integrated circuit, ASIC, technology that has seen use in myriad applications. So what Google is really doing is repurposing an existing technology. As a result, the chances of this sort of chip succeeding in the market are much higher than something like Synapse, which relies on entirely new technology. Increasing hardware capabilities. The CPU still works well for business systems or in applications in which the need for general flexibility in programming outweighs pure processing power. However, GPUs are now the standard for various kinds of data science, machine learning, AI, and deep learning needs. Of course, everyone is constantly looking for the next big thing in the development environment. Both CPUs and GPUs are production-level processors. In the future, you may see one of two kinds of processors used in place of these standards. Application-specific integrated circuits, ASICs. In contrast to general processors, a vendor creates an ASIC for a specific purpose. An ASIC solution offers extremely fast performance using very little power, but it lacks flexibility. An example of an ASIC solution is Google's Tensor Processing Unit, TPU, which is used for speech processing. Field Programmable Gate Arrays, FPGAs. As with an ASIC, a vendor generally crafts an FPGA for a specific purpose. However, contrary to an ASIC, you can program an FPGA to change its underlying functionality. An example of an FPGA solution is Microsoft's Brainwave, which is used for deep learning projects. Remember, the battle between ASICs and FPGAs promises to heat up, with AI developers emerging as the winner. For the time being, Microsoft and FPGAs appear to have taken the lead. The point is that technology is fluid, and you should expect to see new developments. Vendors are also working on entirely new processing types which may or may not actually work as expected. For example, GraphCore is working on an intelligence processing unit, IPU. You have to take the news of these new processors with a grain of salt given the hype that has surrounded the industry in the past. When you see real applications from large companies such as Google and Microsoft, you can start to feel a little more certain about the future of the technology involved. Adding specialized sensors. An essential component of AI is the capability of the AI to simulate human intelligence using a full set of senses. Input provided through senses helps humans develop the various kinds of intelligence described in Chapter 1. A human's senses provide the right sort of input to create an intelligent human. Even assuming that it becomes possible for an AI to fully implement all 7 kinds of intelligence, it still requires the right sort of input to make that intelligence functional. Humans typically have 5 senses with which to interact with the environment: sight, sound, touch, taste, and hearing. Oddly enough, humans still don't fully understand their own capabilities, so it's not too surprising that computers lag when it comes to sensing the environment in the same way that humans do. For example, until recently, taste comprised only 4 elements: salt, sweet, bitter, and sour. However, 2 more tastes now appear on the list: umami and fat. Likewise, some women are tetrachromats who can see 100 million colors rather than the more usual 1 million. Only women can be tetrachromats because of the chromosomal requirements. Knowing quite how many women have this capability isn't even possible yet. Some sources have the number as high as 15%. The use of filtered static and dynamic data enables an AI to interact with humans in specific ways today. For example, consider Alexa, the Amazon device that apparently hears you and then says something back. Even though Alexa doesn't actually understand anything you say, the appearance of communication is quite addicting and encourages people to anthropomorphize these devices. To perform its task at all, Alexa requires access to a special sensor, a microphone that allows it to hear. Actually, Alexa has a number of microphones to help it hear well enough to provide the illusion of understanding. Unfortunately, as advanced as Alexa is, it can't see, feel, touch, or taste anything, which makes it far from human in even the smallest ways. Tip: in some cases, humans actually want their AI to have superior or different senses. An AI that detects motion at night and reacts to it might rely on infrared rather than normal vision. In fact, the use of alternative senses is one of the valid uses for AI today. The capability to work in environments that people can't work in is one reason that some types of robots have become so popular. But working in these environments often requires a set of non-human sensors. Consequently, the topic of sensors actually falls into 2 categories, neither of which is fully defined: human-like sensors and alternative environment sensors. Devising methods to interact with the environment. An AI that is self-contained and never interacts with the environment is useless. Of course, that interaction takes the form of inputs and outputs. The traditional method of providing inputs and outputs is directly through data streams that the computer can understand, such as data sets, text queries, and the like. However, these approaches are hardly human-friendly and require special skills to use. Remember, interacting with an AI is increasingly occurring in ways that humans understand better than they do direct computer contact. For example, input occurs through a series of microphones when you ask Alexa a question. The AI turns the keywords in the question into tokens it can understand. These tokens then initiate computations that form an output. The AI tokenizes the output into a human understandable form, a spoken sentence. You then hear the sentence as Alexa speaks to you through a speaker. In short, to provide useful functionality, Alexa must interact with the environment in two different ways that appeal to humans, but which Alexa doesn't actually understand. Interactions can take many forms. In fact, the number and forms of interaction are increasing continually. For example, an AI can now smell. However, the computer doesn't actually smell anything. Sensors provide a means to turn chemical detection into data that the AI can then use in the same way that it does all other data. The capability to detect chemicals isn't new. The ability to turn the analysis of those chemicals isn't new. Nor are the algorithms used to interact with the resulting data new. What is new is the datasets used to interpret the incoming data as a smell, and those datasets come from human studies. An AI's nose has all sorts of possible uses. For example, think about the AI's capability to use a nose when working in some dangerous environments, such as to smell a gas leak before being able to see it by using other sensors. Physical interactions are also on the rise. Robots that work in assembly lines are old hat, but consider the effects of robots that can drive. These are larger uses of physical interaction. Consider also that an AI can react in smaller ways. Hugh Hare, for example, uses an AI to provide interaction with an intelligent foot. This dynamic foot provides a superior replacement for people who have lost their real foot. Instead of the static sort of feedback that a human gets from a standard prosthetic, this dynamic foot actually provides the sort of active feedback that humans are used to obtaining from a real foot. For example, the amount of pushback from the foot differs when walking uphill than walking downhill. Likewise, navigating a curb requires a different amount of pushback than navigating a step. The point is that as AI becomes more able to perform complex calculations in smaller packages with ever larger data sets, the capability of an AI to perform interesting tasks increases. However, the tasks that the AI performs may not currently have a human category. You may not ever truly interact with an AI that understands your speech, but you may come to rely on an AI that helps you maintain life, or at least makes it more livable.